Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, listen to us at SoundCloud, rate and review us anywhere that you find us, and always check everything we're doing. Check out everything we're doing at Reason.com. Today, we are talking with Brett Smith. He is one of the co-authors of the graphic novel version of Peter Schweitzer's best-selling New York Times book, Clinton Cash, How the Clintons Auctioned U.S. Policy for Profit. We are less than 2 weeks out from the election. So, Brett, it's nice to be talking to you about this.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you are, by trade, you're a graphics illustrator and animator. You've worked with Marvel and DC, probably is the best, as well as every goddamn good advertising agency in the world, Cartoon Network, Hasbro. I'm just looking through your bio at the end of the book. Why did you decide to co-create a graphic novel version of Clinton Cash by Peter Schweitzer?
I was approached by Dan Fluette, who had acquired the graphic rights to Peter's original book almost a year and a half ago. And they were interested in turning it into a graphic novel. And I thought to myself, that book, you know, it's sort of like, that's like one you need a highlighter for. And it's some difficult material. Mm-hmm. I had never read it, but I knew of it. And I knew of Peter as well from his other books, Throw Them All Out, which is a great book.
And Throw Them All Out by Peter Schweitzer actually inspired legislation to rein in the ability of Congress to, of senators and congressmen mm-hmm. to benefit from inside information they had about what rules were going to be passed so they could either buy or sell stock and basically make money off it.
They weren't subject to, is it SEC or FEC?
Yeah, it would be SEC, yeah, of insider trading laws.
Yeah, man, yeah.
And that book, we talked with him about that, and I think we ran an excerpt that Reason about that, which was amazing about how, just bizarrely people, and it included people like John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi. I mean, it was a transpartisan, scam. Where they're sitting on a committee that is going to pass massive new regulations in a particular industry, and lo and behold, they move a bunch of stock that has some relationship to it.
But if you or I did that, or anybody else did that in the private sector, we would go to jail.
Right.
I mean, that's how it works. But one of the things I love about Peter is that he does go after both sides. He even did an ebook called Bush Bucks after Clinton Cash came out, and it traces where the Bush's money come from. And all the Saudi connections and such. But, really, I was kind of like, I asked Dan, I said, okay, so what do you want to do with this thing? You know, you've got the graphic rights. That's great. You know, so what? What do you want to do? And he said, well, that's what we're talking. Yeah, that's why I'm sitting here talking to you. You know, we need a direction. We need a vision. And I said, I think it's an interesting idea. I think it's very timely. And it's definitely going to be, a challenge. And then that was kind of part of how it started.
And it's funny because for those of us, and I'm in my early 50s, so the first graphic novel I remember was The Death of Captain Marvel by Jim Starlin, I think from the 80s. And it may or may not still be considered the first graphic novel. It's certainly one of the early ones. You know, and then you think of stuff like The Watchmen and everything. And now we're looking at, or I'm holding and looking at this beautifully illustrated and really well-wrought piece of work that is Clinton Cash, a graphic novel. Let's talk a little bit about the content of the material here, and then we can talk about how you take this and transform it into a graphic novel. But Clinton Cash, of course, was a broadside attack, in very detailed ways, of how did the Clinton Foundation intersect with Hillary Clinton's time in the Secretary of State, and basically how did the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, use connections in order to kind of generate a huge amount of money for themselves? Can you walk us through some of the examples that you think are particularly illustrative of how the Clintons were, kind of working their political connections for personal gain?
Well, it started while they were in the White House and they were renting out the Lincoln bedroom, to people like Charlie Tree, who I like to call Dr. I Bring Dough. And it wasn't until that they were able to get out of the White House that they could really make all this money, because they didn't have anybody really watching them. And they were also able to go out and work with, foreign donors. something that they, you know, that they skirted with while they're in the White House. But, you know, it's we, you know, it's the opening chapter in our book is the Lincoln bedroom goes global. And that's very much what happened. You know, once the Clintons left the White House and stuck, you know, socks the cat with what's her name?
Yeah.
You know, they were able to go out and work with people, you know, all over the world and form these partnerships with people like Paul Kagame and Reich Mishar and Gilbert Shigori.
Paul Kagame. Who is he? And then, you know, how does the transaction happen where the Clintons are able to get some money out of all this?
You know, it all starts with these speaking fees, these speaking engagements with Bill, where he's paid a lot of money to come to some third world country and give a speech. And it could be about anything. It could be about, you know, turning Haiti into the first wireless country, which the Clinton Foundation promised to do after the Haitian earthquake. Or it could be like with Colombia, opening up trade with Paul Kagame. I think it was gold mining and logging and just, you know, normalizing trade relations so they can make money. And it all starts with Bill getting invited to some third world country run by some autocrat to make a speech for half an hour for $500,000. Or in the case of his the Qatar, you know, they gave him $1 million. And then Hillary works her magic on the other side on the, you know, diplomatically, whether it's as a senator or whether it's secretary of state or as, you know, presidential candidate. I mean, and his speaking fees, and it's documented in Peter's original book as well as in ours, Bill's speaking fees just go straight to the moon as her stature rises over the years. And it's, you know, it's like there's no real smoking gun in this book.
Right.
That's the one thing. Everybody's always looking for the smoking gun. And I always tell people there is no smoking gun. These people are like Spectre. They're like the Sopranos. They're insulated by their capos. And, you know, yes, there's Frank Giustra and there's Cheryl Mills and there's, you know, Blumenthal and these people that insulate them, kind of like Polly Walnuts and right. Silvio Dante, you know. So it's like, yeah, there's nothing really that ever ties back to them directly. But the book is mainly about establishing and breaking down the pattern of behavior, which with visuals, I think helps tremendously.
So, I mean, is Peter Schweitzer's book, as well as your graphic novel version of Clinton Cash, is it really, you know, kind of a diagram of how power works? Because, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of people, and I, you know, I'm always interested in looking at, you know, we know what corruption looks like because we've seen enough movies or we lived through enough moments in the past where somebody would deliver a briefcase or a grocery bag full of dollars to a politician, or you know what a bribe looks like. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen here, and that was one of the criticisms of Schweitzer's book, was that this is interesting, but you know, there were two flavors of criticisms, that he doesn't really nail anything down specifically, that he can't find a specific quid pro quo. This is simply how power operates in the world today. Do you think that's a fair assessment? And it may not be a criticism. It's just, this is how things get done.
When I hear that, I just think to myself, is nobody able to critically think anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, is nobody able to connect the dots? I don't think it's a fair criticism. It's not that cut and dry anywhere. Even with the mob and RICO statutes, it's never quite. I mean, you have to connect the dots. Part of that, you know, part of putting together, I would imagine, something like that would be connecting the dots. I just don't think it's quite that cut and dry. It would be nice if there was a smoking gun, if there was something that tied them directly to it. These emails that have been coming out via WikiLeaks.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because I mean, I mean, does WikiLeaks seem to be a kind of sweet vindication in the sense of
it's helping?
Yeah,
it's helping. Yeah, I mean, that and Project Veritas is definitely showing the collusion between even the Clintons and the media, where they're dining at the Clinton staffers the night before speeches. I mean, this is nuts. She's getting debate questions fed to her. I've never seen a candidate so insulated and so protected by the media in all my life. It's astounding to me. It's also disgusting. Yeah. And it's the same with Clinton Cash. You know, we've been ignored by the mainstream media. People like to poo-poo the book because, like you said, Peter doesn't have a smoking gun. Mm-hmm. But it's like I said, I mean, you've got to be, I mean, completely obtuse or just an absolute rabid Hillary fanatic to not read this book and say, wow, this is really disgusting and abhorrent, and I can't believe it's happening mm-hmm. out in the open, but it is happening. And it's, you know, it's on a massive scale. You know, on the smaller scale, you can just look at, you know, some nobody who runs for Congress and then a couple of years later ends up in the U.S. Senate and he's a millionaire. I mean, it's kind of the same type of symptoms that we see throughout politics where you've got, you know, you got these people that go to Washington and they become, that, you know, they get accepted into the country club. And then no matter their good intentions, no matter if they were, you know, a 2010, you know, Tea Party patriot or whatever, they all seem to get turned once they get up there.
Talk specifically because, you know, in this election, which is, you know, not very far away, and you will, we'll talk a little bit about where you are on that. You are a never Hillary and you are a and you're a Trump voter. So we'll get to that. But mm-hmm. one of the things that's interesting is that the way that Putin and Donald Trump's relationship or, you know, and particularly his ex-campaign manager, Paul Manafort's relationship with Putin and a bunch of other pro-Putin forces in the former Soviet Union came into play. One of the situations that you talk about in the book is how Hillary Clinton approved the transfer of, 20% of U.S. uranium to Putin's Russia. And nine investors in that, there were Russian investors who were funneling money or giving money to the Clinton Foundation. You know, there was also the Russian reset, and Hillary Clinton early on in her her period as Secretary of State had a pretty good line where George Bush had said, oh, I've looked into the eyes of Putin. I've seen his soul and I can work with this guy. She had a pretty good line where she said, you know, this man has no soul. Right. But then she worked, you know, and the Obama administration was working with Russia, and there's this interesting uranium deal. Is Hillary, is she as implicated in some kind of weirdness, with Putin or with Russia as Trump? Because, I mean, the one thing you can say about Trump, there is a bromance there that's kind of strange to my mind, but it's not like he is in a position to, you know, actually do anything with Putin at this point.
I know everybody keeps talking about these ties between it's like the new Red Scare on the left, the new McCarthyism. Everybody's terrified of Russia. Don't want to be implicated with Russians. It's like I've never seen anything like this. And it goes to show you how desperately they want to focus the attention on Trump because, you know, Hillary's already done business with Putin mm-hmm. and she's done really dirty business with Putin, and not just Putin, but with Iran. You know, the transfer of, you know, 20% of U.S. uranium to Russia is not just to Russia. It's for Russia to help build nuclear power plants in Iran. And I don't want to see Iran get a bomb. I just saw yesterday an article about some new Russian intercontinental nuke called the Satan 2.
That with a name like that, I think it's going to fly off the shelves.
Dude, I'm like having flashbacks to the 80s of the MX missile. And mm-hmm. I mean, this is like, this all smells of old 80s Cold War or the last vestiges of some of us who lived during that mm-hmm. period. I remember some of that stuff. You know, they weren't telling us to stop, drop, and roll under our desks. But at the same time, I remember that MX missile scares, you know, that was on the cover of Time magazine. Who's to say that some of this uranium that's been transferred to Russia isn't going into the Satan 2 or isn't going to go into an uranium bomb? Because, you know, I mean, you know, because I kind of doubt that they're just going to stop at nuclear power in Iran. That's just my hunch. But so, Hillary's got a pass with Putin. Nobody will talk about it. It's in our book, and we took portions of the book recently and animated a little info mm-hmm. ad, little cartoon showing this deal with between Hillary and right. Putin and the two of them playing poker. And that's, it's funny. We've done two of those videos, and that one's the most popular. And I think it's because it's the most egregious, I think, out of the book, next to the Clintons' dastardly deeds down in Haiti after the earthquake.
Talk a little bit about that, because the Haiti stuff has come up, and that is also some of the WikiLeaks material and other emails that have come to light talk about the Haiti deal. What did the Clinton Foundation promise to do in Haiti, and what did they deliver?
Well, Hillary was Secretary of State at the time and appointed Bill, basically the viceroy of Haiti. He was the ambassador down there, and he had close to $6 billion at his fingertips. He was in charge of all the money. And of course, you know, they lost something like, it was like 50% of their GDP in 11 minutes after that earthquake or during it. They were absolutely devastated. And the Clintons came down, you know, promising all kinds of things, infrastructure, jobs, normalized trade relations to bring in more jobs to Haiti, and nothing happened. Other than, they were talking about bringing in Clinton homes and building, 50, 60,000 homes. I think they did six. They're talking about bringing in a South Korean clothing garment manufacturer, which was going to provide 50, 60,000 jobs. It provided about 5 or 6,000. The homes, actually, I think it was 5 or 6 homes were built, as I recall. And it's and they were all models.
Yeah, that's those are always the nicest ones, right?
But I mean, where did all this money go, man? Right. I mean, that's the thing. And the Haitians are worse off today than they were when the Clintons left.
Now, do you consider yourself a Republican, or are you a conservative? Are you both of those things? Are you just motivated by anti-Clinton bias? And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, because what I was going to ask is, one of the co-creators of the book is in the back of the Clinton Cash, a graphic novel, which I highly recommend people take a look at. It's very good. And we'll talk a little bit about why, a graphic novel like this works in a second. But Steve Bannon, who was with Breitbart, the Breitbart sites, and is now with the Trump campaign, is there. But is there a problem? It seemed to me, as Republicans were attacking Hillary Clinton, they were always looking for a knockout blow based on corruption or some kind of dark secret, that she had actually, held Paula Jones down while Bill, attacked her or something, rather than actually focusing on her career, particularly as Secretary of State. There is not a lot of good, there's not a lot of victories there. The Russian reset was famously, was a botched job from the beginning. She's still talking about our intervention in Libya as a shining example of what she calls smart power. Her statements on Syria have gone back and forth. She finally apologized for voting for the Iraq war, but it's a real kind of crocodile tears type of apology. Is this a problem with Republicans? They're always looking for the sleaze factor on Hillary Clinton when, in the bright light of day, she just has not been very effective when she's actually held political office.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need both. I don't mind. I would prefer going after Hillary on issues and on policy, because you can just tear her apart. She's got a horrible record. Trump's really focused on the last debate. Just it's bad experience, and it's a really bad record. And all you got to do is just kind of look at it. But at the same time, you've got to be able to get into the dirt with the Clintons. You've got to be able to get down into the mud and fight with them dirty, because that's how they fight. And Republicans are way too busy not only going after the scandals and focusing only on that and not going after her record, which sucks, but also, they're too busy virtue signaling, and saying, oh, well, I'm above that. I'm not going to get down into the mud. It's like Rubio and Cruz. They both said, like in the primaries, Cruz especially said, if it gets down to Bill's extramarital affairs and the personal stuff, I will not go there, because everybody, look how virtuous I am. It's such horse shit. And all we do is we tie one hand behind our back while the Clintons, are tapping more guys into the ring to come in and clobber us. And that's one of the reasons why I like Trump, is that he will go straight back at somebody and he'll get dirty. And he's not, the Trump campaign has been not only totally politically incorrect, but it's also been a virtue signal free zone. And that's one of the things I told everybody on my creative team for Clinton Cash. I said, this is a virtue free signal zone. So get politically incorrect, get dirty, get nasty. We got a lot of creative freedom. Go for it. I'm not interested in playing by their rules. I'm interested in winning. And sometimes it's like Joe Montana said, if you're not cheating, you're not trying.
But do you agree with many critics, and I think I'm one of them, that Trump's campaign has been policy free, and that You know, one of the things in watching him, even in the last,
that's true.
Well, let me give my piece, and then you can beat me up a little bit. Even in the third debate, there was a moment where he was really starting to, you know, land a lot of, I think, solid blows on her, and talking about WikiLeaks and about the distinction between what she says in private conversation, which I have to say, as a libertarian, I kind of like the private Hillary Clinton, at least when she's talking about hemispheric free trade and free movement zones. But then her immediate pivot on all of that was like, oh, well, you know, WikiLeaks, that they come from Russia. And, you know, he's best friends with Putin. And then he's like, then he's talking about himself. Like, he was not smart enough or able enough or not a narcissist enough to actually be like, hey, you know what? This election isn't about me, or this debate isn't. It's about you and about your failure in office, as well as your continued, you know, kind of ooze and sleaze that comes out of your long years of, you know, so-called public service.
Yeah. Yeah. I was sitting there just thinking to myself, why doesn't he bring up Putin and the 20% of uranium? Mm-hmm. You know, right there, why not say, well, you know, Hillary, you've already done business with Putin. Let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm. But the answer is probably he does not know, or he does not care about that kind of stuff. Because in the end, he's, you know, what is his education policy? What is his foreign policy? I mean, he goes back and forth from saying things that I think a lot of people can get behind, which is, you know, that our wealthy allies should be paying for their own defense, and that we will help them, but we're not paying for it all. And, you know, and then on the flip side, that we're going to bomb the shit out of people, and that we're going to torture the wives and families of people that we designate terrorists. So
those are some real extrapolations, if you ask me. I never heard him ever say anything quite like that.
Well, he did say he was going to go after the families of ISIS members and all of that kind of. And all I'm saying, though, is that, you know,
maybe
whatever,
we should.
Well, no, that's a different conversation if you want to have it. All I'm saying is that he does not seem to be very focused on policy either.
I like the tax policy.
Yeah, what do you like about his tax policy?
You know, I like how he's got a bunch of Reagan people working for him. He's got Laffer, he's got Stephen Miller, he's got Larry Kudlow. He's a supply sider. You know, he's talking about lowering rates for everybody. Mm-hmm. I love the business tax, bringing it down to 15%. I love the repatriation of the $2 trillion, which is actually probably somewhere in the, you know, near $5 to $7 trillion. Two is way low.
Do you worry with that? Can I ask, because the, you know, with particularly with Trump's tax policy, he also reduces revenue, as it's been scored by independent groups, you know, from about 18% of GDP down to like 13 or 14%, which really blows a gigantic hole in debt.
If the economy continues to grow at 1%, that would be true.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I am not a zero sum game guy. Mm-hmm. I think that is the biggest horseshit argument. Anybody that argues,
look, nobody has to say let's put it this way. It seems to me unlikely that this is the problem with supply side economics, right? Not that if you reduce taxes, you might stimulate some economic activity that wouldn't happen otherwise, but is it going to more than pay for the revenue that you're giving up? And, you know, just on a straight math question, and I think we've learned from years, and this is something that George W. Bush did. It actually doesn't make up the difference. Or if you're already spending 20% of GDP and at best you're going to get 18% of GDP, if you care about debt and deficits and the effect that has on economic growth and investment behavior, you know, you're still screwed.
The economy never grew under George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. And it grew 1%. We've had 1% growth since
taxes,
Well, he cut marginal rates. Mm. You know, there was a lot of other things that I think you need to do to stimulate the economy. You just don't cut taxes at marginal rates for everybody. I think you've got to do a lot of things to incentivize business. And I don't see anybody in the establishment. Anyway, not even Paul Ryan, who I think he has a degree in economics. This guy's a moron. I don't think these people up there who profess to be these experts, especially the career politicians, I don't think they know jack shit. And I don't think they're any smarter than you or I, which is why I like the idea of Trump saying, hey, I'm going to bring in some killers. OK, I'm going to bring in some people that you wouldn't normally like in life. But these are the people that we want going into doing deals, so as well as negotiating with people on the Hill who are a bunch of geldings, if you ask me.
I don't disagree with you on that. But then when he trots out Carl Icahn, it's like, you know, well, Icahn has to get back into his coffin before morning because he's 1,000 years old. And I'm not sure
That's a name drop, anything.
Well,
if we can get 4 or 5% growth, Nick, you know, there is a lot of things that we'll be able to do. And, you know,
if we can get 3% growth, which is closer to the average in post-war America, we would probably not be having a lot of conversations that we're having because we'd be too busy.
And that's the thing. Gen X, Gen Y, they have absolutely no frame of reference for what a growing, robust, brick shithouse economy like the 80s were under Reagan, where you had quarters where you're growing at 7 and 8%. That's too much. I mean, that's where you start to heat.
Also, a good decade for a lot of that. Can I, before we segue into that, and I want to talk more about your point of view, and particularly as a comic book artist and an illustrator and a creative type, who is both part of Gen X, but is also, you know, coming at it from a kind of populist right perspective, which I think is interesting. And, you know, you don't exist as far as most people, most people think. But talk a little bit about why the graphic novel approach is appealing for this material. Because you were saying, I was reading Schweitzer's book and I was, you were starting to doze off at various places.
Yeah.
I actually, if I may, I'll say to stick up for Peter, and I know you're not slagging him, he's a very good wordsmith, and I find his work amazingly easy to follow, even when it's dealing with something very kind of technical and nuanced. But what's the hook of the graphic novel, and was it fun ultimately to kind of try and crack this nut?
It was a lot of fun, and we weren't trying to replace the original book at all. I have tremendous respect for the original book. Peter and I would both agree, and I asked him this over breakfast one time. I said, is it okay if I call the book dry? And he said, he looked at me and he's like, oh, sure. Yeah, it is. You know, and it is. Sometimes it's kind of like reading stereo instructions. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that love that stuff. They love the detail and immersing themselves in that. I was really interested. And you have to have all that because that original book is just full of exhaustive detail and research. And I was interested in making that more accessible and more understandable to a wider audience, especially casual curious readers. And the casual curious reader is not going to pick up Clinton Cash and plow through that 198 pages. And there's been some people that have emailed me and said, I've read both. I like both. Hmm. But yours is the one that I give to, somebody who is undecided on the fence or somebody who can crank through it quickly. I was also thinking if we can kind of make this stuff, almost like a pop music, almost like your favorite movie line, your favorite guitar solo, something that's really, that you can retain and remember. Cause a lot of this stuff is really complex information. I get confused. Peter gets confused. Was it 145 million that the Russian investors funneled in, or was it 150? It's like sometimes you get this stuff mixed up. So with the visuals, I knew that it would stick in people's minds like a great scene from a movie where you've got the visual and the verbal information going on at once. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's attractive to Gen X and Gen Y is we've grown up on, TV and movies and animation
Graphic novels. I'm not joking when I was talking about the death of Captain Marvel, which I think came out in maybe 82, something like that. As a comic books nerd growing up back in the bad old 70s and 80s when you were seen not even as a juvenile delinquent for reading comics, but just as, off and kind of, you had a bunch of extra chromosomes and all of that kind of stuff. And the death of Captain Marvel, it was like, oh, my God, this art form this commercial form, this base form that covers everything from Batman to Archie Comics, could approach art or writing. It's a novel. And now, of course, we that is taken for granted. And that was one of the great shifts in the 90s and certainly in the 2000s, where nobody is pretending, that graphic novels aren't actually, you know, really serious things.
They, you know, I'm not calling them high art, but mm-hmm. they can certainly be, you know, in Clinton Cash, a graphic novel, that's been a successful and effective form of political persuasion. Mm-hmm. And it's and the best thing about it, I think, the graphic novel, is that it is entertaining. And if we can entertain and inform at the same time, and then also, you know, use humor, that was really when I brought Chuck on, we started talking about, okay, how do we do this? Well, best way to tell the truth is through humor, because it's going to disarm people. And how do we, and then, you know, how do we do the treatment of this? Let's use a lot of satire, right. You know, like the old National Lampoon. It's not going to be like Mad Magazine. It's not going to be like Cracked, because everything's going to be realistically drawn and portrayed. There's a couple scenes in the book where we parody and do some cartoony stuff, but most of the book is realistically done. But I think it's the satire, which is the main vehicle behind the book, which is another reason why Gen Xers and Gen Yers like it. Yeah. But, comics
if I can just interject, when you mentioned Chuck, we're talking about Chuck Dixon.
Oh, yeah, Chuck Dixon.
He's the co-creator of the Batman villain Bane. He's worked on the Simpson comics. He's worked on basically, if you read comics, you've read, you know, something by him. He also did the, if I'm not misremembering, he did the adaptation of Amity Schley's The Forgotten Man, a history of the Great Depression. So, I mean, artists that you're working with here who are all heavyweights, and it is, it's a funny book. And, you know, Jack T. Chick, the Christian pamphlet writer who had a very peculiar style, died recently. And in a way, you know, I was thinking of him in this, not because this is a religious book, but because the way the art works is kind of similar. And there's, you know, Jack T. Chick, for all of his screeds about damnation and hellfire, actually could be kind of funny. And this book itself is, I think it delivers on your claim of satire for sure.
I'm very happy to hear that, because it is a love-hate relationship you're going to have with the book. It is going to make you laugh, but it's also it's ultimately going to abhor, and it's going to make you angry, because, you know, ultimately you read this stuff and it's just kind of like, how is this happening? You know, and one other thing, I was, you know, you brought up how comics have always been kind of, you know, when we were growing up, they're kind of looked down upon, and they've always kind of had sort of a lowbrow entertainment attachment to them. Mm-hmm. But that's part of how the left has been so successful with their subversive nature into arts and entertainment. They've hijacked all of this quote unquote lowbrow stuff. And you've also got to remember that lowbrow is also movies. Lowbrow is jazz, blues, rock and roll, paperback novels. You know, these are how you get your claws into the culture, and you change hearts and minds that way. You don't do it through political speeches. You don't do it through political ads, and you certainly don't do it through white papers. I mean, the right has had their head up their asses for 40 years, thinking that, you know, doing this political ad and speaking to all the intellectuals and effete assholes on our side is going to somehow combat the subversive nature of Captain Planet. You know, wrong. You know, you need to fight fire with fire.
Well,
you need to answer those things.
Let me ask you that, because, and you know, in that you are, it's almost as if you're possessed by the ghost of Andrew Breitbart, who talked a lot about that. And this is an old complaint among right-wingers, and which was a group which used to comfortably include libertarians. I think there's a shift between, you know, more and more of a break, you know, or a distinction between conservatives and libertarians on a lot of stuff. But, you know, the reason why the left, broadly defined, won the 60s is because they had better music, they had better clothing, you know, they had better drugs. I'm not sure that that's right, because when you bring up Captain Planet, is it, you know, doesn't Captain Planet immediately create South Park? And South Park, South Park has, you know, the South Park creators may have a specific politics, but the show's politics is more like, look, everything that you're seeing on TV, and certainly everything that every adult is telling you when you're a kid in school, is probably not true. And it's some of it might be true, but that, you know, you need to build up your bullshit detector. You need to, you know, waterproof it and then use it on everything, which I think is healthy. And so this one of the disagreements I might have with a lot of people kind of aping the Breitbart line is simply that, you know what, like Captain Planet, I know, like, when I think about my kids and when I think about everybody who watched it, they're like, fucking Captain Planet sucks balls. And I don't buy anything out of Captain Planet. That the actual shift in attitudes is coming from somewhere else, which is not
it
to
might,
say
it
that
might a,
yeah,
it might be a weak, you know, a weak comparison, yeah. But there's certainly all kinds of other ones that you know, and it's an obvious one too.
Yeah.
And it's also a funny one because Captain Planet does suck.
Yeah,
I mean, I remember as a kid, it was sort of like, do you want to watch, oh, I don't know, Silverhawks, Thundercats, or Captain Planet or Voltron? It's like, yeah, it's a no brainer.
If Captain Planet's the only thing on, it's like, okay, I'll go outside and actually play, even if it's raining or it's cold out. I can't watch this.
But I'm a big believer, you know, in Andrew's claim that culture is downstream from politics. I think that's very true. And what I was really interested in doing on Clinton Cash graphic novel was making culture and politics intersect. Mm-hmm. And I think we were able to do that really successfully. You know, there have been people in the past in entertainment that have done it successfully. John Hughes, mm-hmm. who is a well-known, or not, probably not a well-known conservative, but, you know, part of the great lineup of National Lampoon in the 80s, and then obviously went on to write some of the iconic movies of the 80s. John Milius, mm-hmm. Pre-Red Dawn.
Wrote the screenplay for Apocalypse Now.
Oh, and yeah. Wind in the Lion, mm-hmm. you know, Conan the Barbarian. I mean, this guy like taught me storytelling and adventure. Sure, you know, and these were probably movies I shouldn't have been watching
true. I mean, if, you know, and this is something as somebody who has a background in literary studies, and there were at various moments people like Lionel Trilling, a literary and cultural critic in the very, very big in mid-20th century America, started one of his books by saying, I would love to engage conservative intellectuals, but there aren't any, because if you're conservative, I'm paraphrasing here, you've got shit for brains and you would never be an intellectual. Kind of echoes of that argument as it affects creative people, linger on. And you can look at people like Jack Kerouac, even people like Allen Ginsberg, who in many ways was part of a conventional left, was also part of a libertarian right.
In the beginning.
Yeah, and, sure. There are William Burroughs, to talk about the Beats, just as the trinity of the Beats, he doesn't fit easily into a political category. And there's no question that, that creative people can have widely varying politics.
Oh,
talk a little bit about where do your politics come from? Because your creativity is not in question. That of Chuck Dixon, that of Christopher Nolan, who, did the Batman movies that are really fascinating, coming out of, a series of Frank Miller texts. Frank Miller, the comic book artist, who is also generally, and I think accurately considered a man of the right to the extent that his politics map.
Frank goes off the deep end on a lot of things.
Mammoth.
He's mm-hmm. kind of like Mammoth who was changed after 9/11. But, I think, I love how you brought up Kerouac. He's a huge hero of mine. Tremendously talented guy and definitely got further, was always a Catholic and kind of veered right, but mm-hmm. certainly got more far right as he got older. I love how complex the Beats were, that you can't mm-hmm. shoo them into, they're neither, round peg or square peg.
Right.
They might be hexagon. I don't know. Yeah. Jack changes sometimes. But, like, I feel the same way. If I could describe myself, I would say I'm kind of a Kurt Russell kind of libertarian, I guess, if Kurt feels like libertarian on that day.
Yeah.
I don't like labels, dude. I don't like alt-right. Alt-right means to me as much as alt-rock.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff is just kind of bullshit, because it's like with Peter Thiel, you can be a gay evangelical conservative if you want to be mm-hmm. in America. You can live that contradiction, and that's a beautiful thing, man. I mean, I don't want to live in another
You
country.
Are like Walt Whitman. You are vast and contain multitudes. Do you contradict yourself? Verily, you do.
Sometimes, but, sure, yeah. sure. I mean, I love those guys too. I love the Romantics. I love mm-hmm. those guys from that revolutionary era, because I think all of them understand the human condition, mm-hmm. which is we're all just a flawed mess, but we're doing, but if you're a good person, you're trying to do your best, and they also understand that I think that the higher power, God, understands that this is a really complex life we live down here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're not expected to be perfect. You know, Jesus took care of that.
Yeah.
But I think I love how complex those guys are, and it's those complexities which make them interesting.
Jesus' big problem was, and a friend of mine who has celiac disease told me this, that, you know, at the when he made the loaves and fishes, they weren't gluten-free. There was no gluten-free option, and that kind of caused a problem. Because the rift, I think that's where Orthodox Catholicism or Christianity comes from. Are you a religious person?
I definitely believe in a higher power. I don't go to church every Sunday. My grandfather used to teach me, who is a Battle of the Bulge survivor, mm-hmm. by the way.
On the German side or the American side? Make sure you ask him that.
German.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this guy in the waning days, he was going up against 13 and 14-year-old German boys who was basically all they had left.
Right.
And some of these guys would, come crying and surrendering, and some of them fought till the death. So it was pretty trying. But he used to tell me,
was in that as well. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. But, he used to tell me there's no atheists in foxholes. And he also used to tell me that you don't have to go to church to be close with God. You can talk with him anytime. And he's like, I talk with him often, and I talked with him a lot during the Battle of the Bulge, especially when he got frozen feet,
It is amazing there is color footage that has come out from World War II, which gets shown on various documentary channels every once in a while. And I saw not too long ago a color documentary about the Battle of the Bulge and what it drove home. And you're right, Germany at that point was throwing up anybody that they could, including, young teenager kids. I mean, it's horrifying. But when you look at the U.S. ally, the soldiers who always seemed old, partly even though they were in their early 20s or late teens, because it was black and white and guys just looked different back then. And you see in color just how young, the people, it's horrifying. Let me ask you, we've got a couple minutes left. Has your politics, is it becoming more common in things like illustration or things like comic books and graphic novels as a couple of things happen? One is that, people, we have more and more different types of people all over the country. People are recognizing that just as we want personalized drinks at Starbucks, we want more personalized politics. Is that coming around, and have you ever had any trouble with, comics is also kind of interesting, particularly the superhero polychromatic underwear, cape do-gooders, because they're kind of vigilantes, and, that means they're generally, like back in the day, they were on the side of Dirty Harry, and, so there was always a kind of populist, to call it right is wrong, but like a law and order mentality there. Have your politics ever gotten in the way of your job?
No, never. I don't let that happen. I've worked on books that I maybe didn't disagree with, one or two things or something. I might not even have liked the character or the book I was working on. It's a job. I've been really, really fortunate, really blessed to have 21 years doing this in comics, advertising, and graphic design. And I've never had any issues with anybody.
For the comic book nerds listening, I mean, the list, the Avengers, Batman, Superman, Wolverine, Suicide Squad, Hulk, Guardians of the Galaxy. This is like working with royalty, right? I mean, you're not getting stuck with Aquaman. Or Matter Eater Lad or any of the shitty Legion of Superhero types.
It's cool. It is. It's fun. It's fun to work on those properties and licenses, which are basically kind of like modern day mythology. You're getting to play with kind of a modern day Theseus or Perseus. Mm-hmm. However, I can't say that it's not boring at this point, because there's so much to do. In the realm of Clinton Cash, I'm really interested in more forays into pop culture on the right for the right, because there's such a vacuum over there. Once in a while we'll get an American Sniper, we'll get a Lone Survivor, maybe we'll get The Passion from Mark Burnett and Roma Doughty. Mm-hmm. We'll get some good stuff every once in a while. It's not enough, man. And that's why I was saying earlier, I think we need more graphic novels, we need more short films, animation. I think, the right ought to be answering the left as far as pop culture in all kinds of different mediums. And again, we got younger people that are coming up, Gen Xers and Gen Y, and they just don't respond to you know, this meat and potato Karl Rove sculpted consultant class ads, you know, I think we've got to get, you know, kind of disassociate politics and just start, mm-hmm. you know, maybe get back to just telling some really cool stories and some really great adventure stories. And we don't have to lecture people about our politics. Right. We can imbue the characters. It's like Jeremiah Johnson. Mm-hmm. You think that guy would be a conservative or kind of lean right? More than likely. It's a great story. And you don't walk away from it with any particular political message. But
don't mess with the crow. Right.
That
with
too.
Crow
yeah.
Indians. Yeah. And respect the people's property you're trespassing on.
But you make a good point. Yeah. Most of the characters in the comic book, the superhero genre, are largely conservative. You even watch some of these movies. They all kind of have a conservative bent. But, you know, if you get into the comics, into editorial, a lot of the people who are in the comic book side, mm-hmm. which is separate from the movie side, it's completely
right.
separate.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them lean left, and yeah. especially the people in power and editorial, a lot of them are Hillary supporters or Bernie supporters, and they don't like Trump at all.
It's funny because I follow a bunch of the guys who were big names when I was reading comics, and mm-hmm. yeah, most of them tend to be kind of not limousine liberals, because back then you couldn't even take a cab. I mean, you were walking everywhere. Bus fare was tough to get if you were writing or drawing comics. But yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for me, a lot of the early comics, which I thought of as high art or, you know, almost high art, were things
me
like
too.
When Green Arrow and Green Lantern, you know, drove around the country with one of the guardians of Oa to see the real America. And he couldn't yeah. go more than they couldn't go more than 15 feet before they found a latter day neo-Nazi cult or, you know, industrialists who were destroying rivers just because they hated fish or something. It was hilarious because on all of this stuff, and there was a great sequence in Captain America where Captain America and a fake Captain America who came about in the 50s fight, you know, and he's become like a latter day McCarthyite in the yeah. early 70s. And they have a big fight in front of the Friendship Torch or something in front of Miami. And you know, I was like, God, this is it. You know, this is so important. And, you know, and that's where one of the reasons where my skepticism about the effect of particular messages in pop culture I think they have less effect on people. Like you can watch, you know, a lot of Aaron Brockovich movies and it doesn't actually create the next generation of Ralph Nader. I think that comes from somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I agree with you completely that if you're conservative, if you're libertarian, if you're liberal, if you're progressive, like, you got to be telling stories that people give a shit about. And the stories for me, culture, I like political art. I like art with the politics. But I also think that if you're merely telling, you know, if you're merely dressing up, I mean, if it's Captain Planet, where it's just horse shit, you know, covered with a cartoon, like that's worse than propaganda, I think. You know,
no, it's got to
it's not even entertaining.
It's got to be fun. You know, it's one of the reasons why. One of the reasons why I agreed to do the graphic novel was we had a great budget on it,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to go out and hire incredibly talented guys, A-listers like Chuck, like Graham Nolan,
mm-hmm.
who was the other co-creator of the Batman character Bane. He and Chuck, you know, I was able to get Paul Revoche, who mm-hmm. did all of the artwork on Andy Schley's Forgotten Man graphic edition. Don Hudson, who was in the Marvel bullpen back in the 80s and the 90s. Sergio Cariello, who mm-hmm. also did the cover. This guy's, you know, worked at Marvel in the 80s.
Yeah.
And in the 90s, he's worked on Lone Ranger and Tarzan and all kinds of great stuff. So I knew, you know, if we get really great talent, it's the same with Clint. You know, he goes, you know, with American Sniper, he goes mm-hmm. out and he gets the best cinematographer. He's got this great crew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to have something of real quality that people are going to look at and say, wow, that's great looking. It's great artwork. It's got this beautiful hardcover. I feel like I'm getting real bang for my buck and I'm learning something. You know, I mean, when was the last time that you sat down and you were entertained while learning something and it came from the right?
Which is why I keep
saying that I think our graphic novel might be, I think it is, probably the most subversive thing the right's ever done when it comes to pop culture. And then on top of that, it's been successful. It's made money and it's also changing hearts and minds. And I think,
well, now
you know,
you're just spiking the football on the rest of us who, you know, try to make money for a living with our creative work. And somehow it eludes us because we're too pure for this world. Let me ask.
Maybe we need to get away from basic prose. You know, I mean, yeah. I do believe for the casual curious reader that graphic novels beat to shit basic prose any day of the week.
Well, that's because you're an illustrator. You know, come on, look, I have command of almost 24 letters of the alphabet. I'm not giving that up anytime soon.
Yeah, but a picture, you know, it's like Marshall McLuhan said, the medium is the message, man. And it's not so much of what you're saying, it's how you're saying it. It's that delivery, that delivery device. And why don't we start combining? It's like a great political cartoon. Dude, that stuff sticks with you forever. And if we start combining our messages, especially libertarian and right leaning, with, I think, some compelling images.
There's no question that iconography is the has been massively popular, and if you research the origins of the diagram of how slaves were transported on ships in early 19th century England, that was a game changer in terms of forcing people to understand what slavery was about, and it helped to really bolster the British Abolition Society. Let me ask you one final point, and we'll end with a Hosea to Clinton Cash and telling people where to buy it and how to buy it. But you also do a podcast, a regular podcast with Lisa DePasquale called Political Punks. And talk a little bit about that. And I've been on it. I appreciate having been on it. I got a lot of nice feedback from it. What is the goal there, and how does it fit into this larger world you're talking about, where you want to be creative, you want to be political, and being a right winger doesn't mean that you can't have fun.
Well, exactly, and these days, leaning right is about avant-garde and punk as you can get. The left certainly own groupthink and the status quo, and all you got to do is look at their candidate. It's just kind of astounding, how vacuous they are over there. And
well,
on our side,
I am no Trump fan under any circumstances, but Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, this is like getting it's like the teachers from Greece, but they're all 100 years older still.
Dude,
and it's like the fun allowed crowd. It's
you
very
know, you
strange.
Know what it is? I've been saying forever that this election, the Atlantic, I don't know who the guy's name is, but the Atlantic put out a really great article months ago called Why 2016 is the Caddyshack Election. And it talks about how Donald Trump is Al Chervik.
Right.
And he shows up as guests of the Scots. He's not a member of Bushwood.
Right.
He's a guest of Doug Kenny, who also stars in the film, the late, great Doug Kenny, and who's doing copious amounts of cocaine in the background, by the way, that nobody knows. But he brings and Rodney Dangerfield, who upsets everybody, pisses everybody off, rubs everybody the wrong way, and says, hey, I would never be a member of this crummy snobatorium. Maybe I'll just buy it.
Right.
This is like life. Life is imitating
and
art.
Hillary Clinton is Ted Knight then, right?
She's constantly doing spit takes
and she's buttoned down. And, when she's
does that make Chelsea
down.
Spalding? Yeah. That's so fantastic.
And then we do have to find a role for Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders because this is one of the tragic, and we'll leave it here. One of the tragicomic, realities of American politics is that the fun party, the party that's supposed to be kind of like cooler and more into fine living and art and culture, if it's being spearheaded by people like Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton, who are school marms, they are school marms out of the worst kind of 19th century, Peck's bad boy kind of writing. And then Bernie Sanders, who has never, has he ever enjoyed a bowl of soup in his life or anything?
He didn't even earn a paycheck until he was 40.
Anti-pleasure candidates. I think the right has its own problems, and Lord knows I don't want to know what Ted Cruz does to kind of unwind. And Trump has his own problems. He has his own appetites and crassness, which I don't mind crassness, but I just kind of don't want to necessarily deal with it. But
It's a
bizarre thing that you know, the baby boom, if this is the last baby boomer election, and I hope to fucking God that it is,
Me too.
That we've served up Hillary Clinton is the person on the left. And, that was, George McGovern was kind of a Puritan mm-hmm. too, but it's
yeah,
like
Mondale. You know, yeah, yeah, Mondale as well.
Terrible, yeah. terrible, terrible.
But you know, as far as political punks, you know, and you're certainly included in that. We were, Lisa and I were talking one day, and we were just kind of like, look at all of these young, interesting people on the right. Guys, you know, people like Gavin McGinnis, Nick Gillespie, Greg Gutfeld, Ann Coulter, Clint Eastwood, mm-hmm. and then you look at
all
people
of these
like,
young guys, and you've named people who are 80
well, they're young
and
at heart.
50.
Young
yeah.
at, hey,
yeah.
they're young at heart, dude. I mean, it's like in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, you know, Jeff Bridges had that great line yeah. where he says, you know, you're as young as you feel. And yeah. and Clint is certainly, you know, an example of that. But yeah. we were kind of like, let's focus. Let's see if we can get people on the air to interview who cut against the right and also cut against the left and are kind of contradictory and interesting like the rest of us. And aren't these virtue signaling people in Washington who hold themselves up and say, look how perfect and virtuous I am and how consistent I am and blah, blah, blah. It's just sort of just this fake sideshow. But I was just sort of astounded one day. I was sitting there thinking to myself, you know, all of the oddballs, all of the interesting people, all the free thinkers, all the people that have all the great ideas, and some of these people are really creative. They're all on our side, and that's something that's needs to be acknowledged.
It is a wonder. The podcast is Political Punks, and I highly recommend people check it out. It's quite good. We're going to leave
here. Hey, Nick, what's the and the other thing? The thing with Trump and Al Chervik. What's the difference between? We're going to make America great again. And hey, everybody, we're all going to get laid.
Yeah.
You know, it's hilarious, man.
Well, we will have to come back and talk about the gendering of the Trump candidacy and what that means. I think it's kind of interesting, but and that may be the last conversation that we ever have, but I think it's a good one to have. Tell us, where is the best place to get Clinton cash? Is it at Amazon? Do you have a particular site that you want to send people to?
Just, you know, Amazon, it's everywhere books are sold. Amazon, mm-hmm. it's at Books A Million, it's at Barnes & Noble. It's even in comic book stores. Mm-hmm. Diamond Distributors finally, you know, got on the bandwagon, started putting it out there at the boutique comic book stores out there. But Amazon's probably the best place to go.
Okay, so what we've been talking about, and we've been talking with Brett Smith, he's an illustrator and an artist, a podcaster, a political punk. And he is most recently one of the authors of Clinton Cash, a graphic novel based on the work by Peter Schweitzer and adapted by Brett and Chuck Dixon. Thanks so much for talking to us, Brett.
Thank you, sir.
And
Appreciate it.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Check us out on SoundCloud at Reason.com. Rate and review us. Tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and the exact proper way to go gargle with razor blades. Thanks so much. I'm Nick Gillespie.